You're listening to a Bucks Plus audio production on the Bucks Plus Network.
Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Here District. I am the captain of this vessel on this fantastic voyage. And a lot of stuff going on. Marcus Johnson, my son Chris Johnson, the only father and son tandem in the history of NCAA basketball to win a national championship. But there's one caveat. At the same school. Yes. UCLA.
Go Bruins, baby.
1975-1995. And without further ado, I'm really privileged, pleased, proud to have this guy on this episode, Here District, episode number 73. 73 was a good year. That was the year I graduated from Crenshaw High School. Man, that was a great first freshman year at UCLA. 73 is a good number, but Mark Stein is the owner and founder of the Stein Line. He's got more than 44,000 subscribers on Substack, of which I am one. I've been one for at least 3 years now, and just love what he puts out there in terms of content. He's got more than 30 years of experience reporting and writing about the NBA. And Chris, he's got something that I don't have, that I wish I had, that plagues me to this very day, that keeps me up at night, man. Just I'm back to biting my nails again and slapping my knees.
Spill the beans.
Mark is a member of the Naismith Memorial Hall of Fame, man. He's in the Hall of Fame, Chris.
We got a heavy hitter.
He got the Kurt Gowdy Media Award in 2019 for excellence in print media. Mark, man, we welcome you to Here District. We thank you so much for joining us.
Man, I'm emotional now hearing that intro. That was, first of all, the way you even set that up is like, you will be there someday. It is more than a disappointment that it has not happened. And anyone who watched you play knows you belong there. And I do believe your time will come. And I'm guessing this is something we'll get to, but I think, you know, the time you played in the 80s probably worked against you because you played at like the hardest time in the NBA to win a championship.
Wow.
But
well, why do you say that, Mark? I mean, just give us some context. Why do you think that?
The 80s, I was in high school in the 80s, and I will always say that was the best time to be an NBA fan. It is when this league exploded and the whole reputation of the NBA changed. And I know you were a rookie in what, 77, 78, you know where this league was. Yeah. I was just a little kid then. Like this league went to a new level in the 80s. But it was a 23-team league, and the good teams were stacked, and the Lakers could bring Bob McAdoo in as their sixth man, and the Celtics could bring in the big redhead, yes, college teammate, as a sixth man, and the poor Milwaukee Bucks could sweep the Celtics 4-0, and then have to deal with Moses Malone and Dr. J in the next round. And that Bucks team was, if my memory is right, the only team in those playoffs to win a game against Philly that year.
Indeed.
In, Moses Malone famously said, fo, 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 and it was 4-5-4, I think. You didn't win a championship with the Bucks because you were in the wrong conference. Yeah. I mean, that was it. Look how long it took Jordan to win one. It didn't happen until 91.
Yeah.
So I think that probably works against you unfairly. There's a lot of great players on those Bucks teams. I was just with Don Nelson at game two of the NBA Finals when he won the Chuck Daly Lifetime Achievement Award from the NBA Coaches Association, and just reliving, like I always say it, I've lived in Dallas for almost 30 years now, but I'm a Southern California native like you guys, and like living in Dallas, but like the 1980s, the Bucks and the Mavericks had such good teams. And I think you could throw Cleveland into that same group. Yeah. Just teams filled with just really good players. And winning was impossible. It was just, It was impossible to win a championship in those days for those teams.
Well, and I throw in the New Jersey Nets with Buck Williams and Albert King and Birdsong and Michael Ray Richardson. I throw in the Atlanta Hawks with Dominique Wilkins and Dan Rounfield. And what they, you know, the product they were putting on the floor was really, really tough, but it just paled in comparison to what the Celtics and Sixers were able to do.
Yeah, Hawks couldn't get out of the second round. It was a 23-team league. It was the best teams at that time were just ridiculously deep.
Mark, as a SoCal native and growing up watching my dad, UCLA, Walton, the Wooden Dynasty, and then obviously watching him go along to the pros, what was it? What was his aura? What was his game? Like, what was it about Marcus Johnson that made him such a legend?
I moved to California. I think it was at the end of his rookie season in Milwaukee. And so I didn't get to see those UCLA teams, but I read about them all and the stature they had. And again, you want to talk about where the NBA was back then. Like, I would be curious to hear if Marcus backs me up on this, but like the aura and stature of UCLA, like, was so massive, obviously because of John Wooden and all the championships, that like I couldn't see the Milwaukee Bucks. After you got traded to the Clippers, I really couldn't see you unless I went to a game. Because in those days, in my memory at least, and I don't trust my memory as much anymore as I used to, but like the Clippers weren't on either. This was not the Steve Ballmer Clippers.
Right, right, right.
The Clippers were very rarely on TV.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just like in 2025, Josiah can be a channel unto himself. Like he's a network unto himself with his content. In 1985, it was so like the NBA just didn't, it was not on every day. Yeah. And it was not on our screens all the time. And really, what changed it for me as a high school kid was SportsCenter. SportsCenter changed everything. Just having SportsCenter and CNNSI having nightly highlight shows, 11:30 Eastern, 8:30 in California, and being able to see if the Bucks and Hawks are playing. And all of a sudden, we have highlights? We can actually, like, so at least we had that.
Yeah.
And that was a massive game changer just as a fan. But I mean, I'm trying to think outside of, I mean, Mr. Johnson, I'm sure you played in Magic Summer Game more than once.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
So I'm guessing that's the only time I probably ever saw you play in person.
Wow.
That would be my guess.
Wow.
Because like somehow I was lucky enough, like Magic Johnson every year would have this incredible exhibition game at the Forum in like August or September, and all the big stars of the day would play in this game. And I did manage to get to that two or three times at least. And that thing was awesome.
Well, a little history lesson. The precursor to that, my agent, friend, mentor, Willie Knowles, he had an organization called Soulville that helped underprivileged youth get to basketball camps. Jerry West was actively involved with that. But he was the first one to put on those all-star games, those big-time all-star games in the summer. And I can remember watching Sidney Wicks and Dr. J back in the mid-70s kind of go at it, Mark. And that was just, I mean, Sidney Wicks held his own. People won't believe me when I say that, but he more than held his own against Dr. J. But then Magic kind of took it over after that, and it just became a thing, man. And yeah, some great, great memories. And you're right. I mean, back then, before the advent of cable TV, I think the thing I want to mention is that the other thing that happened too was that the Big East and ESPN, I think, came into collusion.
Big Monday.
So now all of a sudden, Stevie Thompson and who else? Chris, Jason Hart, all these West Coast guys started to proliferate to the East Coast and go to UConn and go to Kevin Ollie and go to Stevie Thompson, Syracuse, and schools like that, man. And it was just live, man. It was a live period because you're right. You didn't see a lot of basketball on TV. ABC, CBS had the game of the week on Sundays, and you might get a game during the week in your local teams, of course, but there was a whole different era, man.
But you read about it and you kept up with the box scores. I know that's what I did, Mark. I knew everybody's stats. I knew everybody's, you know, everything that was in the NBA. That's how I kept up with everybody.
Well, SportsCenter was just, like I said, SportsCenter was a godsend. Yeah. Like, this is, like, I had a group of like 12 friends in high school. Only one of us had a video machine, and he actually had a beta. It wasn't even a VHS. And it was like, your job every night is to tape to every dunk in the NBA, tape it. And then we would go to his house at lunch the next day. Man. And just like all of a sudden we could see dunks from, you know, again, the Cavs. I just saw Ron Harper at Summer League. Yep. Like, people do not remember what kind of player Ron Harper was in Cleveland. And just like to all, like, so I moved to California in 78. I would say for the first 2-3 years that I was there, the White Shadow television show was our basketball. Like the Lakers were on. The Lakers were on a fair bit, but like that was more prevalent than actual games. And then, like I said, ESPN starts in 79, and then a few years after that is like when my group of friends figured out, oh my God, on SportsCenter every night we can actually see these guys play. And like the All-Star game back then, you cannot imagine what a big deal the All-Star game was in, you know, 83, 84, 85. It was just, it was, you know, it was magical to even just intros to watch these guys, because like that's in today's NBA, all of these players are in our lives every second. Right. I mean, And it's just, it's a completely different fan experience.
Well, to that point, I mean, it's interesting, and I won't belabor this point much longer, but when I was at Crenshaw, Mark, 1972, my teammate Terry O'Neill, he was from Massachusetts. He told me about this guy, Julius Irving, but he also told me that CBS had this ABA game of the week on Saturday mornings, probably started at 1 o'clock Eastern time, but 10 o'clock out west. I'd get up every Saturday and the Virginia Squires were always on. And that's when I first saw Dr. J and George, a young George Gervin playing with the Squires and the red and white blue basketball, man. It just blew me away watching Julius with the fro and the cool and the big hands and the athleticism and you know, the basketball crush Chris was on right then and there. And he has been my favorite. My all-time idol, Dr. J. Even now, I get nervous, kind of in his presence.
He is pretty much the coolest human ever.
No question.
And that's like I didn't get to see any of the ABA, but it's like what you're talking about. That's how I felt in the '80s with games on CBS. Like most people would tell you, the NBC and Round Ball Rock and that music is magical. That's how I get when I hear the CBS theme from the '80s, because like it was just having. A game on the weekend was so special. Yep. Baseball was so far and away the number one sport, and baseball was in our midst every day. Yep. And like, it was special when an NBA game came on. It wasn't every day.
Yeah. All right, man, let's talk about today's NBA. I guess I got to pull myself out of the past and into the present here. But Mark, what lessons can we draw from the two teams that made it to the finals, the mid-major teams, mid-market teams, mid-major if they were college teams, but just constructed in such a way for success that allowed them to compete for the ultimate prize. But it's a copycat league. Oftentimes, offenses and go big, go small, play more zone, all that stuff. What do you think the impact will be from how the Pacers and the Thunder kind of piece together their lineups?
Well, in some ways, OKC is really hard to replicate because they just have such a stockpile of draft picks. And there are a few other teams that do as well, but just the way they've constructed their team, so young, they just extended all their best players, but those extensions don't even kick in right away. So they still have a season before the big money has to start going out. Like, I don't know that you can really replicate the OKC model, but I think the thing that teams are trying to borrow from the Thunder, just the multiple ball handlers. In today's NBA, you're best off when you have two or even three guys who can really play make, create, and do something with the ball. And I think a lot of everybody wants that if they can. We just saw Brooklyn keep 5 first-round picks, which is, I don't know that that's ever happened, and everybody Brooklyn drafted can do something with the ball. I don't think that was an accident. From the Indiana side, I think what you see is in this double luxury tax apron era, it's really hard to have more than two max guys on your team and be able to put a team around them. And Indiana has done that fantastically. Halliburton and Siakam are their two main guys. And then they just have so much depth around them. And I think you're going to see teams try to copy that and see if they can emulate that formula. Because once you're paying three guys major, major money, it's just really hard to balance out the rest of your team.
And Mark, because of the apron and the restrictions, do you think more teams will look to get younger, sign younger players, take chances on second round guys, try to give the first round picks the development runway so that they can potentially hit instead of having to, you know, wait for free agency each year? What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, second round picks, two ways, even finding the undrafted gem here. And that it's always been important, but it's more important than ever now. Like, you have to, like, one of the keys to Indiana's success, really, they got Nebhard in the second round.
Man.
Every single team in the league would love to have this guy now.
Yeah.
He's the perfect complement to Halliburton. And they extended him to the max that they could extend him. So his salary went, it's going now from like $2 million to $18 million. But in the context of today's NBA, $18 million is still a bargain. And like, to get a player that good at that number, like, it's huge. I mean, you cannot overstate how important that is. I mean, there is, any team will tell you that you have to have some luck along the way too. But it's those kind of targets and stories that can change the trajectory of your whole team.
Well, we talk about how the game, it keeps evolving. And I mean, you mentioned Brooklyn and how they pick guys that could handle the ball, just positionless basketball. But Mark, my old broadcasting partner, Jim Paschke, used to say that positionless basketball works at every position except one, the point guard. Now the Bucks got to put the ball in Giannis's hand. They're calling it point Giannis. Good buddy of mine, Lloyd Walton, who's been on our show, played at Marquette for Al McGuire. He didn't like the move. He's talking about, you know, his vision and his ability to pass out of a crowd and his mindset of attacking in close games may hurt the Bucks. What do you think the ceiling for success, if the ball is in Giannis's hands with shooters around him, is that something that you think the Bucks can ride deep into the playoffs?
The Bucks had limited flexibility. They saw an opportunity to go get Miles Turner, and they made it happen. I mean, the one thing you have to say about John Horst and the Bucks, he is not afraid. He is not afraid to take some massive swings. They traded for Jrue Holiday. It led to a championship and a contract extension for Giannis. They traded for Damian Lillard. Okay, that did not work out the way anybody hoped it would, but that also led to a contract extension with Giannis Antetokounmpo. Is the Miles Turner move enough to make Giannis happy and for this team to contend again? I mean, the good news for the Bucks is the East is very wide open, and they do still have, as we speak, one of the three best players on earth. So I'm not going to sit here and say it can't work. But look, you guys know I'm based in Dallas, and we have this conversation about the Mavericks every day. The Mavericks have a huge team now, talented bigs. They just won the lottery with a 1.8% chance to bring in Cooper Flagg, but they're not going to see Kyrie Irving until 2026. And you have to ask, do the Mavericks have enough playmaking and ball handling to compete in a ridiculously deep Western Conference? And I don't have the answer for you at the end of July. Now, the Bucks being in the East, that does help. That does help a lot. And I mean, Giannis is still an other world. I mean, I can't believe it's year 13. How on earth is it this guy been in the league 12 years? Is there enough playmaking? Is there enough shooting? Is there enough depth? And again, I appreciate that they only had a limited amount of flexibility to make moves, but I think they maxed out with what they could do. Yeah. On July 1st, I can tell you nobody around the league, nobody, least of all in Indianapolis, thought Turner was going to end up with the Bucks. And to be able to bring in Cole Anthony, to keep Gary Trent Jr. Like, they've made good moves around the edges, but you can ask me 25 times. There's only one guy whose opinion matters here, and it's not John Horst, and it's not Doc Rivers, and it's not Marcus Johnson. He wears number 34. what he thinks is all that matters, and that's the truth.
And he's done a masterful job of. I was playing golf with a buddy of mine this morning, Bob Webb, and he's like, "Well, it looks like Giannis is going to stay in Milwaukee." I said, "Well, Bob, Giannis wasn't going anywhere. Every year, he does a masterful job of holding John Horst's feet to the fire and said, man, do something." The first year, they go Bledsoe for Drew Holiday. Then we try to – I mean, he brought in some players, Pau Gasol. We brought in Mirotić, Chris. I mean, John is always – at the margins, trying to improve this basketball team. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But Mark, just in terms of the moves that John Horst has made, you've got to have a really solid working relationship between superstar and general manager, right? I mean, just to make this thing work properly.
Well, like I said, he's not afraid. I mean, they have taken massive, massive swings. But look, I've got to be candid with you. As a national reporter, Giannis is the only one who can speak to these things. I would love to ask him myself. I would love to get myself the Eurobasket to ask him. And my instinct is that whoever is at Eurobasket will ask him, and Giannis will say, "I'm here for my national team right now. We'll talk about the Bucks when this thing is over." But again, only he can speak to his contentment level with the roster and where things are. But as long as you have him on the team, you have a chance. He's that good, and I have to think that. You know, Giannis and the Bucks have had some real health misfortune in the playoffs the last couple springs. That's got to turn here at some point. There's got to be a healthy postseason for this team, and let's see what they can do.
Where do you stand on the NBA guys competing in Eurobasket this year so close to training camp? You think that it's any kind of, it's weird at all, or you think it's just normal?
International basketball has been a huge part of my life, and I'm a huge fan of it. So I love it. Eurobasket itself is such a good tournament because it's now been expanded to 24 teams, but pretty much every team has NBA players. And as a fan, it's tremendous that in late August, when we're like, God, training camp is a month away, but all of a sudden we get this bonus two plus weeks of games, you know, in the middle of the day and at lunchtime and, you know, after lunch. And it's, for us, it's a nice treat. But yeah, for teams, it's obviously every team is scared to death because we have so many injuries.
Yeah.
Like we just had a playoffs with just three horrendous Achilles tears. And there is nothing more dreaded in basketball injury wise than an Achilles tear. So yeah, when you're a team and you're paying these guys zillions of dollars and they go to play for their country, of course you're scared and nervous, but you see how much it means to these players. I mean, if Giannis could lead Greece to a Eurobasket championship, I think you would see him cry as hard as he did when the Bucks won. Like, Greece hasn't won a major championship, I believe, since 2004. I mean, again, I don't want to speak for Giannis. I don't know him that well, but I would imagine that would be beyond meaningful for him to lead Greece to a Eurobasket title. So, you know, having covered Luka Doncic for his whole time in Dallas, I mean, there's nothing that means more to him than playing for Slovenia. And to me, you can't take that away from these guys. The NBA can't draft players from all these countries and say, don't play for your national team ever again. But it's tough. It is very nervy for the teams.
But Mark, so I'm just wondering if you have any insight on this at all. If you don't, that's fine. But how much cooperation between FIBA and the NBA? I mean, the Olympics were from July to August. This is a month later. This is late August until mid-September. You get a couple of weeks off, 3 weeks off, and then training camp starts. Is there conversations between these two organizations in terms of the medical staffs and all that, just trying to figure out the best approach, or is this as FIBA's like, this is what we're doing, this is what we're gonna have a tournament, the NBA be damned, and y'all figure it out on your end?
Look, by the letter of the law, if a federation asks for a player, the player is supposed to go. But have we seen situations where an NBA team behind the scenes tells its player, we'd really prefer if you don't play? Of course, that happens every summer, and it will happen again this summer, and we will hear those stories. I'd rather hear your guys' perspective on this than me. I would think as a player, it's better when the tournament is closer to camp. I wouldn't want to be all ramped up as a player for the Olympics, and then that finishes in early August. Then you have a long break before camp, and then you got to do it again. Isn't it easier to transition from Eurobasket ends relatively close to training camp? Doesn't that make it easier to just walk right into camp? Maybe I'm wrong, but that's how I see it.
Well, for me, the only thing, so it ends September 14th. Camp's probably going to start the 1st of October. You got 2 weeks of downtime. Now you got to kind of ramp it back up. I think, too, like with Greece, for example, Chris was telling me this before we came on air, that they have got to do well in Eurobasket to qualify. So Giannis has got to be, he's got to go all out. And your point's well taken. I mean, 6 in one hand, half a dozen in the other. I mean, I could see an earlier tournament, close to when the season ends and then a couple of months off. But as you pointed out, I don't know how you feel about that, Chris, but it just seems a little close right now to training camp to mentally and emotionally and physically be playing so hard and so aggressive and playing for something like
that. I just think Giannis is used to it. MJ, I think Giannis is used to this lifestyle of playing for Greece and going to training camp. He did it last year. My only concern would be the FIBA courts and just recalibrating myself to NBA rules and the NBA flow and all that. The courts are a little bit harder. I think that's known. And so that would be my only concern. But for Giannis, I think it's great. He credited, I think it was 2021, he did a similar thing, but he credited the FIBA stuff for helping him expand his passing, get him sharp, increase his vision. Yeah. So I think it's a positive.
Yeah.
I really think the modern player tends to stay in shape all summer long anyway.
Yeah.
The notion of I'm going to get in shape at camp is not, that's just not the way it is anymore.
Yeah.
I guess just using, it just seems to me that if the Olympics are always earlier in the summer, to me, that would be hard to get in game shape in July. And then it ends in early August and now you're off for a whole month and then you got to ramp up again. I don't see the lateness of Eurobasket as being a huge detriment.
Well, it's going to be exciting, man. And one last question from me, and you'd mentioned the fact that the NBA, the Eastern Conference is wide open, but man, it seems like every pundit that I listen to, when they talk about where the Bucks are going to finish, they have the Bucks anywhere from 4 to 6 or 7. They talk about the Cavs and the Lonzo Ball, what he's going to make mean to that team. They talk about the Knicks, what they've got coming back. They
the
talk
Magic.
About the Orlando Magic, and they've Hawks. Even thrown it. They've thrown Atlanta.
Atlanta, nice.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, yeah, nice old paper. But Mark, where are you looking at the Bucks? If everything holds the form, health is great, the Bucks are playing as well as they can play, and everything is equal with the other teams, how good can this Bucks team be?
I think I'm one of those pundits that you don't like, because I think the Hawks really had a nice summer. So I would say Cavs, Knicks, Magic, you have to put them in a tier at the top, and I would put the Hawks at the top of the next tier. But again, there's only one Giannis. There's only one Giannis in the East. If he's on the court for 70 games and healthy in the playoffs, nobody's going to want to play Milwaukee. So, I wouldn't get too worried or caught up in what the pundits are saying. And maybe I think he might actually enjoy being, a team that slept on a bit and has a chance to sneak up on people.
Well, listen, man, nobody's going to sleep on you, man. We love what you do. Keep up the great work.
Am I allowed to ask a couple questions before we go?
Without question.
Because I have to ask, too. I mean, first of all, I was just in high school. I can still remember what a massive shock it was when you got traded from Milwaukee to the Clippers. So please allow the teenager in me to ask you, I'm sure you can talk about it more openly now than you could then. What was that like for you? Because obviously you get, on one hand, you're coming home. But again, those were not the Steve Ballmer Clippers that you were joining.
Yeah, the best of times, the worst of times. Yeah. but what's interesting, you talked about Don Nelson and spending some time with Nelly. But Nelly actually warned me. He didn't tell me, he warned me. He was like, MJ, don't expect what you experience here as a Milwaukee Bucks to experience that with the Clippers. They're all over the place. It's a crazy organization. I'm sending you home, but I'm telling you, it's he didn't say show, but that was the inference. And so and at that time, as the series clipped, has done a pretty good job of documenting. But this is in the mid '80s, Mark. So I got there, and Donald Sterling. First of all, we the Lakers were practicing either in Hawaii or Santa Barbara, staying at the Ritz-Carlton's. We practiced at Cal Poly Pomona, staying at an Econo Lodge.
Yeah,
paper. This is the honest to God truth. Hard floors.
I know.
At Cal Poly Pomona, the Econo Lodge, and Donald Sterling had myself, Norm Nixon, Michael Cage, Don Chaney, the coach. He had probably five or six lawsuits for $500 moving expense here, you know, $300 moving expense, you know, $1,000, you know, just the most petty type of stuff that you can imagine. And Donald made the comment in the LA Times, was, I think the reporter Mark asked him, so you think of your players like your kids, your son? And Donald was like, no, not at all. I think of them as like racehorses. You know, the one gets hurt, you replace them with another one. You know, you put them out of their misery. No, but so that was the mindset. And then you compound that, Mark, with the fact that across town at the Forum in Inglewood, you had the greatest show on earth. Voila, Magic and Kareem and Worthy, and that, you know, Jamal, my guy, that whole crew, man. So it was it was rough, man, to say the least. It was rough. We tried to make it happen.
So were you mad?
No,
the Bucks?
No, not at all. I mean, I'd been with Nelly 7 years. We'd had our issues, especially earlier in my career. I think it was time. There comes a point in time, you know, when you've kind of done your penance. Is kind of how I looked at it. And this chance to go to L.A. was a great opportunity. And as I tell people, hell, if I was Don Nelson and you got a chance to get Terry Cummings, one of my all-time favorite players, just in terms of skill and strength and, you know, versatility, I would do the same thing. Now, I don't think they got any further than I was able to help this team get in the playoffs. But on paper, it looked like he was a few years younger, bigger, stronger, the same skill set, maybe a little bit, a better outside shooter. And so I would have done a similar thing, but I wasn't mad. It was time. It was time to try something new. And I was naive enough to believe I could go to L.A. with the talent that we had, Norm Nixon and Derek Smith, who was a budding all-star at that point in time before he got hurt, James Donaldson, Curt, you know, we just had a really solid roster of players that I thought could challenge for the playoffs, but it starts from the top down, and from the top down, it was just way too much dysfunction. So you didn't, I mean, you know, Cedric Maxwell, once he was traded for Bill Walton to the Clippers, you know, we had a chance to make the playoffs, Chris. We had to win like 4 out of 5 games. I'm like, yeah. Max, we're in the shower. Max, 4 out of 5, we're in the playoffs. He like Cap, he like pantomime, he was dialing on the cell phone. I'm calling my pool man right now, telling him to get the pool ready, get the leaves off the tennis. He said, this stuff is over with, man. You tripping, man. We ain't gonna win 4 out of 5. And I think we lost all 5 games at the end of the season. So he was right.
Well, the other thing, I mean, they didn't just get Cummings. I mean, didn't they get Ricky Pierce and Craig Hodges?
Yes.
I mean, that was
Ricky Pierce, a 20-point per game score. You know, people don't realize coming off the bench.
Yeah, that's huge. Time. God,
two 20-point
per game scores for what? Oh, man, that's big.
And we gave up myself, Junior Bridgman, the late great Junior Bridgman, came to LA with me, and then Harvey Catching. So yeah,
Harv.
I had to ask this one, and now look, I want to make this clear. You should be in the Hall of Fame for your playing resume, and it's not even a question. But after White Men Can't Jump, I mean, that, like, on that performance alone, you should be in the Hall of Fame. The greatest basketball movie of all time. You're actually in two of my top five because I sneak Forget Paris as my number five, and you were in that.
Yeah.
Nice.
I'm probably the only one who has it in the top five, but I love Billy Crystal that much. And also that movie really captured the referee sports writer travel part of the NBA that I could really appreciate. So you were in that too, but I could not watch. I have not watched the remake. I'm not watching the remake.
Me either.
There are some movies that should not be remade, and that is one of them.
Yeah.
Are we on the same page?
Absolutely. Especially since they didn't ask me to do a
cameo,
a recurring role as Raymond in the remake. You know, I don't know why they would pass up on that opportunity. Cameo, cameo appearance, but no, man, I appreciate
that. How could anybody play that besides you? Like, it's just, it's impossible.
Well, I appreciate that, man. Well, listen, man, thank you. Keep up the great work. We thank you for stopping by. Hopefully we'll see you again down the road here once everything kind of picks up with the season, man. But you do a tremendous job, and we're just honored to have you on here, District.
Thank you for all the kind words. Thanks for having me, and we will do it again for sure.
Yes, sounds good. All right, here, District. Fantastic voyage. We want to thank Mark Stein for joining us on the Fantastic Voyage Substack. The Stein Line, 44,000 plus subscribers, of which I am one. And do yourself a treat and check him out on Substack. He does a great job. But listen, man, I want to talk about something. I love talking about the memories of players. One of my topics I had broached with a few guys is kind of like, what was that rite of passage win against an older brother, against your father? How old were you? Kind of, did your dad ever play you again? All that good stuff. And right now there's a lot of conversation about first dunks, man. And that talk about just bringing back memories. But we've got some interesting ages, man. Some pretty young dunkers out there, Chris. Speaking of Chris Livingston, 12 years old. Now that makes sense because
12 is ridiculous, though.
But I've read where in Akron he was just this man child at 13, 14, obviously at 12. But LeBron would come. And LeBron and Rich Paul would go and see him play in AAU games. They'd sit there because he's supposed to be the next dude. And at 21 years old now, he's actually, I think, put himself in a position with the work that he has put in, Chris, to get some rotation minutes. I'm going to go out there and say it right now. Chris Livingston, man, looks good. He averaged 20 a game in the summer league. Body looks great. Activity, energy's always been there, athleticism. But now he's got that offensive confidence coming, and I think it's going to bode well. But he was 12. DeMar DeRozan, I remember him talking about being 12 years old, his first dunk. Tyler Smith, another Buck, was 13 years old. Who else is out there, Chris?
Bobby Portis.
Bobby was 14, okay.
Giannis was 15.
Yeah, and Giannis talked about that with, what's the guy's name? I Show Speed, that his first dunk was at Sapolia. This is the court right here where I got my first. He was 15. Now, that's kind of old, right, for when you think about Giannis?
I guess, you know, when you look at Giannis, how tall he might have been. My thinking is, like, how tall were these dudes at that age? And did they, like, undergo a growth spurt? Were they in the midst of a growth spurt? Because when I did my first dunk, I was 15 years old at Montclair Prep. And I dunked with my uniform on, my khaki pants, white, regular shirt, polo shirt.
School jersey, yeah.
A belt. I had on a belt. I had on the whole nine. And I dunked at recess at Montclair Prep. During nutrition,
right,
and I was like 6'3", 6'4", about 250 at the time, yeah. And when I did it, it was a shock to the whole gym. The Collins twins, Jason and Jaren, they were seventh graders, and I think they might have been standing under the basket and tried to jump when I did it too.
Were they dunking? Were they dunking back then?
They were almost dunking. They were close because we would do this thing where we would challenge each other to block the dunk at recess at Montclair Prep. So I would start at the wing, you know, gather my steps. Jaren or Jason would stand underneath the basket and try to jump and block it. So they got dunked on several times.
Yeah, well, so for me, my first dunk, my most memorable was like a miss. And this was at a afternoon shoot around at Dorsey High School. I'm in the 10th grade, sophomore, 14 years old, which is young. So I couldn't play varsity until the last couple of games of the season. The coach moved me up anyway. I was still 14. But I'm 14, Chris. And so now you had to get dressed up for these road trips. I had on this fake suede brown jacket and some blue shoes and some black hard dress shoes. And everybody's in the gym shooting around. So a couple of guys, older guys, I could dunk. James Herman and Larry Elkins. And they had Big Tex. He's a 10th grader too, but he was like 20 years old as a 10th grader, so he's a different story. But Tex was always older. But Tex was dunking at 16 as a 10th grader. But I'm 14. And so they give me the ball, say, Marcus, let's see if you can dunk. And I'm, you know, and I've never dunked before, and I never even really tried on a serious basis to dunk. But I just sauntered up to the basket real slowly. I jumped, Chris. I don't know how warm I was. I just almost jumped cold, and I threw it hard off the heel of the rim, the back part of the rim. I got up so high, I just threw it off the back part, and it didn't go in. But everybody was like, whoa, you know, and I was like, whoa, myself. So, and then I think I actually dug later in that spring after the season had ended. We had our spring league and I turned 15. But that showed me that I had the ability, man, that the athleticism was kicking in.
Let me ask you this. Do you remember either dunking on me or being dunked on by me during our one-on-one battles when I was growing up? Because I remember that you used to dunk on me pretty frequently, but I'm not sure you remember. But do you remember me dunking on you?
You dunked on me at the Wooden Center, right?
For the first and last time.
You caught it at the free throw line. We were playing like a 3-on-3 or something, and I was waiting for you to come lay it up so I could swipe.
You had on your Warrior sweats and your sweatshirt. You tried to come in. I was just
You came in through. you hammered that sucker on me. And
but because there was a lot of frustration. Like we played 1-on-1 between the ages of like 13 and 18, and I swear in our front yard we had a goal, and me and my dad would be playing games till 11 or 13 and play a 7-game series. He's sweeping me every day. Literally for about 5 years. So he was like 1,000 and something. And then I finally got lucky at UCLA. I think you were there to do some stuff for radio, and you had on some regular clothes and you got out there with me, but I won. We played the 5. It was like 5-4. Yeah. But it was my first win, was literally in college as a freshman when you're up at UCLA to do some work for radio. You just happened to, okay, I'll play you right now, Chris. Come on, let's go.
That's funny.
Okay.
That's funny, man. Well,
great memory.
Yeah. And I mean, I'll take that. You were a freshman before you were able to beat me. So, hey, you were good. You know, UCLA, all that good stuff. And so now we talked about Giannis, 15 years old at the Sapolia Playground. He did a live stream with a guy you just turned me on. This whole live stream phenomena, I show speed. I had no idea who this dude was, and you, what, 48 million, 41 million followers or some crazy number. Went to Greece, did a great live stream with Giannis. They went to Sapolia, the playground where Giannis grew up, and he tried to dunk. I show speed. I mean, he got close.
I mean, I counted. I'm counting that dunk.
He said it was his first dunk. So
he's 5'3".
Is it?
This dude is 5'5" max, bro. Wow. Like, come on. That's what I was trying to tell you. I'm like, so he did that. He just one step.
He was cold. He was cold. I mean,
I show speed is one of the best athletes on the planet, bar none, that doesn't play a professional or collegiate sport. Like, he is literally, he got speed. He can hang with Noah Lyles in the 100. You saw he can dunk. And he can do like flips, boxing, soccer. I mean, this guy's amazing.
Yeah, Giannis talking about him doing a backflip and a small squirt. I mean, but do you think he's faster than Cat Williams? Cat Williams and his
100%. He's world class.
His 4.3. Cat says he's got a 4.3 40.
Cat's lying. I show speed is legit. He just beat this other dude on the internet. I mean, he's gonna dust dudes like
Cat. Cat's lying.
Lying like a mug. Hey, well, what do you take about this stream? Like, as somebody from your generation, MJ.
Yeah.
And I know that was probably literally your first stream you probably ever like watched. Like, what do you think about streaming? This concept of streaming.
Well, they said something on Facebook Live or something that you could do a kind of a minimalist version of a live stream. So people started doing that, and I thought it was fascinating. Sure. And I even go out on a limb here. You used to have a kind of a live stream thing you would do down in Atlanta when you were how old, 20s maybe? The style,
2008, when Barack Obama was elected president. Yeah, I was on Ustream. Yeah. I had this show. Yeah. It was this platform called Ustream, and I would do The Legend of Stani with my little brother, I Love McConan. We would do like all these shows and do musical stuff and skits,
talk for hours. How, like hours. 3, 4, 5, 6 hours. And I would tune in and watch and make comments. You get pissed off because I was upsetting your flow. I'd say a little funny stuff from your childhood or something. Yeah, Bookiehead. You're like my dad. You ignore me and keep moving on because you're in character. But so that was fascinating watching Giannis and his stream. But then also the Stud Buds and the WNBA All-Star Game. Their stream was how they went hours and hours, or they just would.
They streamed for 72. They basically streamed for 72 straight hours.
Okay.
Yeah, they did everything at the WNBA All-Star Game. I think it's really a unique time in our society right now, because what we saw I don't know if you watched the BET Awards, but Kai Cenat, a really famous streamer, he did a similar thing at the BET Awards. Okay. So what it's doing and what it has done, it gives the audience like a fly on the wall, behind the scenes, high level access sort of experience from like the major players. So it's not like you're just getting some cameraman's viewpoint. You're getting Kai Cenat's like viewpoint, and everybody he's shaking hands with, you're seeing, and they come up on the screen. So I think that's very legit. As far as the stud butts are concerned, I thought it was amazing, but it kind of created a little bit of a firestorm because of the popularity of the show that the stream that they did over the 72 hours, it attracted attention to some pretty big hitters. Dave Portnoy of Barstool Sports fame being one of them. And so because Dave has sort of a sketchy past with some things that he said that, you know, we won't really get into, you can look it up. The question was, how ethical is it to bring a guy like this on with them being who they are? And like we were talking about with this counterculture thing, it just puts the WNBA in a light right now. And I'm of the opinion where, you know, if you got publicity, you got eyeballs on you, it's good for your situation to a certain extent. But in today's day and age, almost all publicity is good publicity if you're not really crossing the line or stepping over boundaries.
Well,
so what do you think?
Well, I mean, so you got the players in line for the CBA negotiations to get an upgrade in pay. They came out with the T-shirts, well, pay us what you owe us or whatever. Yeah. They had 40 WNBA players attend the meeting, and they were talking about just how historical the participation of the current players were in the negotiations, even though the negotiations, at least the early rounds, didn't go as the players, I think, would have liked them to go. But, I mean, it's time for this league to capitalize on historical popularity. Caitlin Clark has a lot to do with that. But Paige Beckers and Angel Reese. They can't leave out – people want to leave out Angel Reese, but you got to throw Angel. She's on the cover of, NBA 2K or some video game that people are up in arms with because she made the cover of that. But here's the deal. So the stud buds, you just wonder, you know, in terms of family friendliness, how does that play? How does that play in Peoria? You know what I mean? Or wherever, Omaha, or wherever. Are you concerned with that? Are you just, this is who we are, take it or leave it, this is who we're going to be, and accept us as we are, or don't accept us at all? So that's got to be the discussion that these ladies need to have in terms of their public relations approach and image and all that stuff, if they want to craft one.
I think that this group is going to be like one of the first groups of professional athletes that we have ever seen where your public image is not going to be. I just look, these people are unapologetically who they are, right?
Yeah.
So that is their thing. Like, they're not going to compromise that. They're not going to change that. They're not going to shy away from that. So it's up to, you know, brands and corporate America to either evolve in their thinking and get behind people like this, because there are 100 million people or 50 million people in America that are like that, right? That are right. Similar to them, that see the world through their lens, that act like them, that walk, talk like them, that see Courtney Williams on a stud bud screen and they feel like they can relate. So it begs the question, the old school way of doing things, the old school mentality concept of how we do stuff. I was guilty of it. Because look, they were on stream with the commissioner, Kathy Engelbert, they were dancing to Nuck If You Buck. Nuck If You Buck. Nuck. And Kathy's out there dancing. Well,
what is Nuck If You Buck? What is there?
It's a live song from like the Dirty South. Like, it'd be like playing like Cash Money Records or, you know, some hardcore, Dirty South.
No limit. Luther Campbell.
If You Buck.
Okay.
Nuck If You Buck. Right. So, but anyway, beside that. Right. I even tweeted out, like, yeah, the WNBA has got to choose between cash and culture. And people lit me up in the comments. And when I go through the comments, I'm reading. I'm like, it helped me get an understanding. Like, maybe that statement was, maybe they shouldn't have to choose. Why do they have to choose?
Yeah.
Why can't they be who they are and still get cash?
Right.
And that's just what it is. Like, you know, we put constraints and we expect people to fall into boxes. And I think this is one of those scenarios where you got to let them be who they are, even if it's out the box. And if, as long as they aren't alienating, to your point about family friendly, as long as they don't alienate groups, I don't think I have a problem with it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still trying to figure this out. I mean, you know, I'm from the past generation. And again, you know.
So am I. Shoot.
To your point, I mean, it's a different generation. It's we've evolved in terms of just where we are right now as a society. Yeah, and I don't even know. It's about it. Like you say, I mean, there's nothing wrong with expressing who you are and not getting caught up. And this has been one of the issues of my generation, people pleasing and perception and all that stuff. Have we gone past that point? I guess we shall see. I don't know.
It would be nice, MJ, to be in a place where people can be their true selves and don't have to conform, don't have to put on their corporate hat or put on this hat when they're around this group of people and be accepted. Yeah. It's all about acceptance. And to me, the Stud Buds, what they have done over the All-Star weekend, they have sort of broke down the doors and, you know, they've made a lot of new fans.
Yeah.
I've sat there, I'm watching 20 hours of that stuff. I mean, it was literally one of the most entertaining weekends of television that I have ever seen in my life. So, you know, they're going to get a lot of new fans. I'm interested to see what this interview with Portnoy goes like, but they're live, man. And I like where the direction everything's going, man. It's about time, dude. Yeah.
Well, you know, having a daughter in love with the sport, in love with the WNBA, in love with all these ladies that you just talked about. And you know, so it's allowed me to enhance my awareness and sensitivity and everything else involved in women's basketball. And I'm excited. I'm just excited about where it is now and excited about where it's going to head in the next 10 years or so. So, you know, and things like this, like you say, eyeballs were on the WNBA All-Star game, even though Caitlin Clark didn't play. That was not even the story. The story was just, you know, the commissioner out there. You nuck if you buck. That was the story. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, I'm having fun with it, but that's not a bad thing. So anyway. But anyway, man, great spending time with you this afternoon. We had covered a lot of great topics. First dunk, we had Mark Stein doing his thing and talking a lot about Giannis and all that. Talked about Thanasis, my guy, trying to get back with the Bucks also. So, you know, it's a fantastic voyage. That's why we're here, man. We bring it to you every week, man. Different developments all the time, man. So, hey, we'll see what's in store for us next week. All right, we're out of here.
This has been a Bucks Plus audio production.